lecture by Rabbi David Kaplan. Rabbi Kaplan is originally from Chicago. He attended Northeastern University and received his rabbinical ordination in Jerusalem. He has lectured widely in Israel and America and is currently a senior lecturer at the main campus in Jerusalem.
Okay, 401 is the mitzvah of the daily sacrifice. Right? Now, the daily sacrifice is that every day in the Beis HaMikdash, they have to bring two sheep. One was brought in the morning, and one was brought in the evening. Right? Now, this is the, and no matter what else was brought during the course of the day, this had to be brought in the Beis HaMikdash. The day started, the first offering of the day, these are communal sacrifices, right? The daily tamid, literally it means the constant offering. It means every single day of the year. Yom Kippur, Shabbos, Yontif, besides the special sacrifices to commemorate whatever the occasion is, on every single day they had to bring what was called the tamid. There's a tamid shel shachar, the daily, the constant offering brought in the morning, and the tamid shel bein harbayim, the tamid which is brought in the afternoon. This is brought every single day by the kohanim in the Beis HaMikdash. It was two 1-year-old sheep, right? They bring one in the morning, one in the afternoon. Now, the idea here is obvious, right? Considering this is the first sacrifice and the last sacrifice of the day. Right? The idea is obvious. A, why you have a constant offering, and why the constant offering is split into two. Right? Why is it? It's obvious. Why do you have the constant offering? And why is it split into two?
To show God around.
Exactly. A constant awareness of God, that we should be conscious of God at the start of the day, and we should be conscious of God at the end of the day. Right? Eventually, you're constantly connecting with God. That's the idea of prayer. They made the times of davening to coincide with the sacrifices in the Beis HaMikdash. You've got the morning sacrifice, you've got the afternoon sacrifice, and then during the course of the evening, they were burning things on the altar. That's what Myrib corresponds to. The evening prayer corresponds to. But what the idea of davening is, the constant focus, the constant contact with God, that everywhere you go, everything you're doing, you're constantly looking for a minion. That's why it's something that is both, on the one hand, it could be, I'm not complaining, but it could be viewed as annoying. Right? That here you are, you're right in the middle of an amusement park, and you're having a great time, and you're getting into it, and all of a sudden, ding, 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 your alarm goes up, I haven't davened mincha yet, and it's getting dark. Right? Now you got to go find somewhere to put down your cotton candy and your snow cone, right, and figure out a way to go daven mincha. Right, or find somewhere where there's no noise and daven mincha. Davening, it could involve davening in airports, davening on camping trips, right? Everywhere you go, everything focuses around davening. That is the reality of life, that you're at a wedding, wherever you are, the first thing you have to think of, you're always conscious of davening. Davening, hopefully, is a way of thinking to yourself about thinking about God. I told you a story about the rabbi where the problem is how people view davening, but the guy during mincha and marav, where the rabbi gets up, they used to daven. You go to shul, you daven in the morning, then you go down in the afternoon, you daven mincha, and you daven marav. So between mincha and marav, so very often the rabbi gets up and gives a little speech in the shul. So the rabbi got up, I told you that story already. No, I did tell you the story. The rabbi gets up in the middle of between mincha and marav and starts saying, look, we have to dedicate ourselves to Hashem, and we have to think about Hashem, and we have to be more focused on Hashem, and we have to, our whole life should be for Hashem. And there's some old man in the back, he says, come on, forget about Hashem, let's start davening. which unfortunately very often is the case. People go through a lifetime, an entire life, think about that. The more you think about it, it's like you can go through a lifetime without knowing what you're doing, without realizing what you're doing. Right, so that's the idea. The davening is the idea of focusing on a good baruch every day, and that's the idea of 100 brachas daily also. That 100 times a day, we have to come into contact with Hashem. Every time we make a bracha, we have to be thinking of Hashem.
About the sacrifices, those everyday sacrifices, you can't light things on Shabbos.
So on Shabbos, the halachas of the laws of Shabbos, the certain laws didn't apply in the Beis HaMikdash. Specifically in the Beis HaMikdash, certain laws did not apply. I don't know which ones did, which ones did, but the sacrifice certainly, the law of the sacrifice certainly didn't apply. The burning, I don't know when the burning was done. That's an interesting question. That I don't know if the burning was done in the Beis HaMikdash, because the fires were existing already before Shabbos. They didn't light this fire. The fire was already existing. So it could be that they wrote the burning. That I don't remember. But there were other laws that didn't apply specifically in the Beis HaMikdash. Those laws didn't apply. Right, so there are two holy places where the laws of Shabbat don't apply in the Beis HaMikdash in the Jewish Theological Seminary. right? Because you know, they're talking about the water, the job is going to apply, right? But then most other places, the law didn't apply. L'havdol elvav be'avdolos. Okay, now one of the commentaries says also the idea here is how often do we eat? Right? How often does a person eat?
All
right, so what we call three times a day, the Gemara always refers to this twice a day. And I think that according from the from comes out from the Gemara that breakfast was not, and even nowadays, in our head, breakfast is not really a meal. Many people skip breakfast. Right? When you think of eating, you think of twice a day. You think of your daily meal, you think of lunch, and you think of dinner. Breakfast is just kind of to just put something into the system. Right, so the Gemara says that, I'm sorry?
It is, but we don't treat it
that way. Yeah, all nutritional books tell you that, right? We don't treat it that way. Right, you don't have your big meal for breakfast, right? You eat something, you know, you eat some cereal or some sugar-laden cereal for the, you know, for part of what they call sugar pops or something. Yeah, that's what you eat for breakfast. But the eating habits have always been, the Gemara talks about eating bread for breakfast. Now, they eat bread, but the meal itself, when you eat a meal, you think of two meals a day, one in the morning and one in the evening.
Wait,
and
there's a thing to do. You mean in the afternoon?
One in the afternoon, right. One during the day, one in the day, I'm sorry, one in the day hours and one in the evening hours. Right. Now, the idea here is that what would happen is that if man is involved in the preparation of his own meals twice a day, and he doesn't concern himself with God more than that, or at least that amount, so it looks like he's putting his own self ahead as a priority over God, right? Therefore, the Torah comes along and says, you take care of your meals twice a day, and metaphorically speaking, obviously God doesn't eat, right? But it's called, the burning on the sacrifice is called consumption, right? It's called achilas samizbeach, the consumption of the altar, that you should not put your needs ahead of God's needs. You should put you should burn things on the altar in order to equate God to your level.
Is that the full burning, complete fashion?
Yeah, these were burned completely. The Kohanim did not eat these sacrifices. Okay. 402 is the mitzvah to bring the Korban Musaf on Shabbos. Now, some of these we just had recently. These are repeated in Parshas Pinchas. 402 is to bring two sheep as a Korban Musaf on Shabbos, and that's why we say Musaf on Shabbos. Right? The Musaf prayer on Shabbos coincides with the two sheep. If you look in the Musaf prayer, when you say the Musaf on Shabbos, look through the Musaf prayer, it goes through, it quotes in the Siddur, it quotes the verses, thanks, it quotes the verses in the Torah, look at that, I missed it by a mile, right, it says, here, it quotes on page 468, it quotes the verses directly in the Torah. The verses where the Torah gives the command of the Musaf sacrifice are quoted in the Shabbos Shmon Esrei, right? Ubiyom haShabbos Shnei Kvasim Bnei Shanah Tamimim Shnei Esrim. This is a direct quote from the Torah. That's part of that will always be the highlight of any Musaf prayer that you say. When you say Musaf, thanks. When you say a Musaf on even Rosh Hashanah, you mentioned Rosh Hashanah, but when you say Musaf during the holidays, Pesach, Sukkot, Shavuos, you will always say the Musaf on that day. And that's why in Chol Hamoed, each day of Chol Hamoed, you say, you know how you look through the Siddur for the specific one for that day because there's a sacrifice brought on every day of Chol Hamoed, a Musaf sacrifice. Okay, so that's 402.
The same.
Depends. On Sukkot, they're different. On Sukkot, they're different. Pesach, Sukkot, they're different. Yeah.
We fulfill the mitzvah since we don't go into the sacrifice.
According to the commentaries, if you say the sacrifices, that's the equivalent of having brought the sacrifice. If you say the sacrifices, the commentaries say, the person who says the sacrifices conscientiously, it is the he gets reward as if he has actually brought the sacrifices in the Beis Hamikdash. And at a minimum, if you don't say all of them, because we don't have time to say all of them, you should say at a minimum the daily one, the tamid. There's a paragraph of the Korban Tamid, this one that we're doing right now, the morning sacrifice, the afternoon sacrifice, at a minimum we should say that one. Some people have the custom saying before in the morning and mental. I personally do not have time to say all the sacrifices, right? Could be I should make time, but whatever it is, I don't have time, but I try to make a point of saying at least the one that the Tamid that's brought every day. And if a person knows, I think I saw somewhere, I don't remember for sure, but I think I saw somewhere that if a person knows for a fact that they did an Avera, right, a certain aver which requires a korban chatas, so then you should say the paragraph for the korban chatas. And again, you just have to be careful. It doesn't mean it's not licensed to then go out and doing great. Again, I brought a sacrifice, but you have to, if you did it unintentionally. Intentionally, you can't do it. But unintentional aver is
the
korban chatas. The korban chatas. Not the one in the musaf. The korban chatas is the sin offering. Somebody who flicks a light switch.
Like that.
Also, in the siddur is printed in the beginning of the korbanos.
Okay.
So you can show all those people that need it, you can show them where it is. The 403 is the mitzvah to bring a korban musaf on Rosh Chodesh, right? On Rosh Chodesh you have to bring a musaf sacrifice. And here also, the idea of Rosh Chodesh is a reminder. That means for the holidays we have a special sacrifice, a reminder of the holidays. And on Rosh Chodesh we have a special reminder of Rosh Chodesh, because Rosh Chodesh is renewal. Right? The word Chodesh in Hebrew, month, it comes from Chadash, right? Chodesh and Chadash are the same root. It's renewal, right? So Rosh Chodesh is the renewal of the moon. The moon disappears.
Every month
the moon disappears. And at the end of the month, and then there's what's called the Nola. The Nola literally means the birth, right? There's a rebirth. I have to be careful using that term. There's a rebirth of the moon each month. Right, and then the moon, it gradually fades, and just when you think you're not going to see it again, then it starts to reappear, which is supposed to be symbolic of the Jewish people in general. It's just the Jewish people seem to fade, and they're almost gone. Next thing you know, the Jewish people are reappearing on the horizon, and they grow into complete prominence by the 15th of the month. That's when the moon is most prominent. Then again, it starts to fade. Rosh Chodesh is we mark Rosh Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh becomes a time where we acknowledge the fact that all renewal comes from God. Everything, the constellations, everything is under God's control, and that's the sacrifice on Rosh Chodesh. It starts at, there's a break point at the end. It gets smaller and smaller and smaller. By the end of the month, it starts. It fades completely. And then there's what's called the sighting when the new moon could be sighted. That's why the times of the Beis Hamikdash, they would cite the new moon, and based on witnesses citing the new moon, that based in the court would proclaim which day is Rosh Chodesh. Right?
So what's it called, Molad?
The Molad is that it's born. I mean, the rebirth of that sighting of the new moon, where the moon now becomes visible again. A slight little speck. So if the witnesses at the time of the Beis Hamikdash, the witnesses saw the new moon, they would come to court, and that would become the first day of the month. And if they didn't see it, so then it was a leap month. The month was full.
The month will end.
In other words, you got a Jewish month is either 29 or 30 days. You got to click. The Jewish month is either 29 or 30 days. If on day number 30, right, that means you didn't even know what today was until the next day, right? Today is now the 30th day of Iyar, right? Today is the 30th day of Iyar, right? And what happens is witnesses on the 30th day of Iyar spot the new moon. They come to the court. And the court says to them, they get testimony from them, they cross-examine them, and if like they saw was indeed, because the court had a calculation, it worked in two ways. There was a mathematical calculation when it could be seen, plus witnesses spotting it. Now, if the witnesses said they spotted the new moon, and the court knew based on calculations where the moon had to appear in the sky, and they had to check that it wasn't some cloud formation that they saw, as opposed to the moon, and they come and they say, we saw the new moon, Basin would take their testimony and say, okay, today is the first day of the month. So what was the 30th day of the month has now turned into the first day of the month, which means the previous month is 29 days, as opposed to 30 days. And if no witnesses would turn up, then the 30th day remains as it is, and then the next day, 31st day, so to speak, is the first of the next month. Okay, let's go on. 404 is the mitzvah to bring the musaf sacrifice on Shavuos. One more technical mitzvah. 405 is the mitzvah to hear the shofar on the first day of Tishrei, which we spoke about recently. Right, that was also in Emor, where it goes through the holidays. The only thing to point out is that the Torah never mentions the word shofar. Right, just you should be aware of that. The Torah never says the word shofar. Right, the Torah calls it Yom Teruah, a day of Teruah, a day of sounding the sound. Right, but the Torah never refers to the shofar. Same way, the Torah never says the word tefillin. You know that. Never says the word tefillin in the Torah. Never says the word. Never says where to sacrifice an animal. Doesn't say to shecht it at the neck. Right. Doesn't say to slaughter an animal at the neck. A lot of things it doesn't say in the Torah. Right. All of these things are part of the tradition, and we know that the shofar is the horn of an animal. It's got to be a curved horn. Right. With the curving symbolizes what? You notice the shofar is curved. You know why it's curved? Why don't you use a straight horn, a straight shofar? The curve symbolizes that we're bending ourselves, right? That certain amount of subjugation, right? And we are subjugating ourselves on Rosh Hashanah to God. That's why it's got to be a curved shofar. Okay.
Subjugating ourselves for Hashem.
We're bending to the divine will.
We're, so to speak, we're bending in face of Hashem. Okay, now here's the one I wanted to get to. 406. Fascinating idea here. The technical mitzvah is the mitzvah of releasing people from their vows. Okay, now that means as follows. Let's say a person makes a vow. A person vows. You know what a neder is? A neder is a vow as opposed to a shavua. A shavua is a swearing or an oath. A neder is a vow of some sort. A person says, for instance, I will explain everything. A person says, for instance, that he makes a neder that he is no longer going to eat meat. A person makes a neder that he's not going to eat meat. Right? When you are putting something into a forbidden category, that is generally where the word neder applies. A shavua, an oath, is generally meant to refer to something which you are affirming a fact. Right? If you are affirming a fact in court, or you are saying something did happen, something didn't happen, then you would use the terminology of a shavua. I swear, right? That's the terminology you use. When you're trying to categorize something, or you're trying to force yourself to do something, right? The person says he makes a neder that he's going to finish all of Baba Kama within 2 weeks, right? You're trying to make a pledge of some sort, a vow, in order to get yourself to accomplish something. Or your person vows off of meat. He decides he wants to try to avoid eating meat for a while, so he vows off of meat. That's called a neder. Now, the halacha is that when a person has made a neder, I wouldn't say inevitably, but very often it happens, the person vows he's not going to eat meat, right? That night he goes with his buddies, right, and they go to a wedding, and he didn't realize that they're having some of that, what did you call it stuff, that raw steak?
Steak tartare.
Steak tartare, whatever it's called, which he didn't realize how good such a thing could be, right? Nothing like raw meat, and he decides, hey, you know, I'd love to eat the raw meat, but he's got a problem now because he made an effort. And it's a strict prohibition in the Torah to break your word when you make a neder, right? Therefore, he's got a problem now. He wants to eat the meat, but he can't because he's bound by his neder. So the halacha is, and this is what the mitzvah is, the mitzvah is that the Torah scholar has to, a Torah scholar, somebody who is a chacham, somebody who is a responsible authority, has to evaluate the situation and determine whether or not he can be released from his vow. Now, how do you release somebody from a vow? And again, only a Torah scholar could do it. You have to ask him, at the time of your vow, did you realize that that vow included steak tartare, whatever it's called, right? Did you realize that that was included? If he says, no, I didn't, he can be released retroactively from his vow. That means there was never a vow over here. It was a vow under mistaken circumstances, right? You're released retroactively from your vow. Now, you need a Torah scholar to do this because a Torah scholar has to assess the situation and he has to see how important and how seriously you're relating to the concept of vows. You can't just go around making vows and say, well, I'll get it released, no problem, right? You could only get it released because sometimes people throw vows around, right? And you have to be very careful not to do that. The classic situation, the guy makes a vow, he just wants to annoy somebody, so he makes a vow, and then later on I'll go and get it released. So the Torah scholar has to determine, the Talmud Chacham has to determine whether or not this person should be released, right? And the Gemara even talks about where somebody, if the Torah authority sees that this person is not taking vows seriously, he has to really rebuke him in the harshest terms. Now, there's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that says as follows, very interesting Mishnah. The Mishnah says, I'll tell you the part that relates to the vows. The Mishnah says, don't suggest things to somebody when he is in the middle of making a vow. That means, if a person says, I vow off of meat, right, for instance, Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, don't start throwing suggestions. Do you mean to include hamburger meat? Yes, hamburger meat too. Do you mean to include steak? Yes, steak too. Do you mean to include raw meat? Yes, raw meat also. What are you doing if you're there throwing out suggestions?
You're reducing his ability to get it.
Exactly. What you're doing is you're going to make it more difficult for him to eventually get released from his vow. Because at the time that you vow, think to yourself, anytime you've made any type of resolution, at the time of the resolution, you mean for good, everything for good, right? When you go into a restaurant or you buy something, you bring it home and you overeat. Right? I think it's the best example. You buy some cake or donuts or something and you overeat, right? So you've had your 9 donuts and you vow you're never going to have a donut again, right? Because at the time, you know, it's when people quit smoking cigarettes. Like, when do you quit smoking cigarettes? When you've got a headache from smoking and you've just had your last one, at that point you quit smoking. No one ever quits smoking when they want another cigarette and they crumple up or drench the pack at that point. That they never do. They always drench the pack right after they've had just one more, right? You drench, then when you don't feel like a cigarette anyway, then you, at that point you really don't ever want to smoke again. Now, if somebody were to say to you, do you include in your oath all cigarettes, all cigars, so on and so forth, you've blocked any type of release from the vow, from the nether. So if you throw suggestions at somebody, like when they've made the nether, you're blocking their release, you're making it more difficult for them to get released from their nether. And this is what Pirkei Avos says, don't throw out these suggestions. Now the Mishnah is very interesting. The Mishnah says there are 4 categories what you're not supposed to do.
They make these vows at their own time, like you're saying, they make it at their own time, like they just eat and they're full.
If a person is eaten and he's full, when he makes the vow, when he vows off of donuts, at that point, you really intend to never eat donuts again.
Yeah, but you're full. You don't really, I mean, you said because you're full at that moment.
Again, at the time that you made the vow, you really don't want to eat another donut. The way you feel right now, you don't ever want to look at another donut. 5 hours later, when you're no longer full, then donuts start to look a little better, right? But at the moment that you made the vow, you really intend in your mind that you never want to eat another donut. And if somebody starts saying, well, do you mean chocolate-covered ones and white-covered ones and sprinkly ones? And you'll say, yes, 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 and you're blocking yourself from ever getting out of the vow. Therefore, it says, don't go and make suggestions to somebody when he's in the process of making his vow. Now, the same Mishnah says, and it's also Pirkei Avos, which I always tell you, is the classic on human psychology, right? And you'll probably see yourself in here somewhere, right? If you don't, then you don't know yourself very well, right? Anybody with any sensitivity to themselves will see themselves here. It says, don't appease your friend at his moment of anger. Don't appease somebody when he's angry, when he's in a fit of anger. If somebody's having a temper tantrum, that is not the time to try to calm them down. Right. What happens to somebody when you try to calm him down while when he's angry? He gets more angry, of course. Right? When you try to calm somebody when he's angry, right, then what happens? They start throwing things. Right? That gets worse, right? If somebody think to yourself, and everybody thinks that they're a big chacham, you know, I know how to calm people down, right? Somebody's going off, somebody's flying off the handle, you have to look really calm down a little bit, right? That's when that irritates people even more. So Pirkei Avos says, somebody who's, while he's in the fit of anger, that is not the time to try to calm somebody down, right? And when you tell somebody calm down, you're making a big fuss out of nothing, that's when they really fly off, right? So that's the first thing. Don't try to calm somebody down when he's angry. The second is, don't comfort somebody when his decease is in front of him. That means that in the period between the time of the death having taken place and the actual burial, then it's not the time to comfort somebody. Not comfort somebody before the burial. Before the burial, and I saw one of the commentators that the first Israel says, because what he needs more than anything else at that point, somebody who you try to comfort him at that point, his reaction is that, why doesn't this person feel my pain? He obviously doesn't feel the pain, and that's what the person needs more than anything else, is simply somebody to feel the pain with him. Right? The truth is that that's the trick in comforting in general, that to comfort a mourner is not to tell them that things are not so bad. That's crass and insensitive. The comforting of the mourner is to tell the mourner, is to show the mourner that you are feeling part of his pain, because the pain needs to be shared. The tsar, the pain needs to be shared. So that's al tishtadal, not to comfort him when his debt is in front of him. And the last one is, don't make an effort to see somebody when he is doing something wrong. That means if you see somebody is doing there are different wrongs that people do. Let's say somebody does an avera. Right? So your roommate or your friend, right, he sneaks off, right, and he goes and has a cheeseburger. Right? And you happen to walk into the room and you see him while he's munching. Now he doesn't see you yet. Now you have one of two choices. You could close the door and walk out silently, or you could kind of close the door and say, hey, look, don't worry, you know, we all stumble once in a while, and talk to him about it. Right? So you would think that perhaps that's what he wants more than anything else, is to hear a kind, comforting word about how his Yetzer got the best of him, comes on Pirkei Avos, and Pirkei Avos says, don't do that, because he's going to be humiliated and embarrassed, right? The last thing he wants is to know that he's been seen. Like, that if you're in a situation where you see somebody doing something wrong, that's why whenever you see somebody in any type of situation, your friend, it doesn't have to be with Averis necessarily, right? It could be somebody who's been, you know, he's been taken into the principal's office, right, where he's in hot water for some reason or another, right, and you're watching him getting it, he's getting it good, right? Leave the premises, right? Get away from it. Don't let him see. Don't let him notice that. Don't let him know that you've seen what he's going through, his shame and degradation. That's also shtadl rosa b'shas kagoso. So here the mitzvah is that when you see somebody make a netter, not to throw suggestions at him. Now, you asked earlier about what about bli netter? Right, what about people say bli netter? So first of all,
I heard they nullify, like in case I know when it's just in case I break it in the beginning.
So the basic idea of a bli netter is to make a statement that I'm not making a netter, because a netter is made not only by what you say, a netter can be made by what your actions are. It could be a netter even if you don't say I'm making a netter. I'm not saying with a netter, right? But it could become a netter even if you just do, for instance, if you do a mitzvah activity 3 times in a row, that's considered a netter. Right? Let's say you do a mitzvah activity, mitzvah action 3 times in a row. Let's say you get up for the 6 o'clock meeting 3 times in a row. Then you practically have made a netter that you are going to go to that mitzvah, right? Now, there's nothing to worry about. I don't go to shul anymore, right? No, you have to, any type of mitzvah activity, any type of commitment. The mitzvah is difficult to know exactly when it is. Let's say you go to the, I think I could be go to the mikveh every Friday. If you do that 3 times in a row, maybe that's a netter. To get out of that, you'd have to have a taras nedarim of some sort, right? To have your netter released. But the point is that if you want to avoid that, you say, I'm doing this without a netter. Bli netter. Now, sometimes people say, when you ask somebody if they're going to do something, can you do me a favor? Can you make sure that while I'm going to water my plants? Yeah, bli netter. Right? So people think that means, bli netter means go take a hike. Right? Bli netter is the firm way of saying, right, you know, bli netter, you mean you're brushing it off. Not when a bli netter means you're going to do it. Right. Bli netter means I'm going to do it, I just don't want it to be an oath, right? So you have to be careful not to say bli netter. I know my brother told me he once went to the Arab in the yeshiva, right, where in the yeshiva where he was studying, right, because there were no towels in the bathroom, but, you know, to wipe your hands when you come out of the bathroom, so he wiped up to the Arab, and he said to the Arab, Musa, can you do something about the towels over here? Bli netter. And he knows what bli netter means, you know, bli netter means that go do something yourself, right? Bli netter means you take a flying leap. That's what bli netter is. It's not what bli netter means. Bli netter means you don't want to bind yourself in a vow. I heard once, by the way, there was this guy's mother-in-law, this is not my favorite mother-in-law joke, but this guy's mother-in-law was visiting, and she decided she wanted to take a trip to Tzfat. So she said to her son-in-law, I want you to arrange me a cab to take me to Tzfat, but I don't want one of those Arab cab drivers. So son-in-law says, okay, don't worry. And he calls his friend, the Arab cab driver, who's much cheaper. And he says, hey, Musa, do me a favor. Okay, why don't you take my mother-in-law to Tzfat? But do me a favor, put on a yarmulke. Right? So the Arab says, okay, fine, sure, takes the mother-in-law to Tzfat. I can spend the day together. She comes back, and son-in-law says to her, so ma, you know, what do you think of the cab driver? He was such a nice man, and a Talmud Chacham, too. Because he had to be there. No, because sometimes you find that this Arab Faiz here in the yeshiva, and there's every halacha you can possibly go, you know, he'll say good job, they'll good job, they'll say good job, you know, when they hang around, they know, you know, they know all the, yeah, they, so. Anyway, that's 406. Any questions on the netters? Okay, 407 is that we are not allowed to deviate from what we've, now again, 406, the technical mitzvah is that the Talmud Chacham has to make the judgment whether or not to release them. He has to make the assessment. That's the mitzvah. 407 is that we are not to deviate from what we've committed ourselves to through our netter. That means if we made a commitment through a netter, we have an obligation in a very severest form to fulfill it. The Gemara says that the punishment for not fulfilling the Dorim, there are all sorts of nasty punishments, including the loss, chas v'shalom, of spouse and children. Right, so a person has a very severe obligation to fulfill any nedarim that they make, especially where you have pledged money. That means in a shul where the shul have where they have a an appeal in the shul, and everybody people raise their hands and they yell out number amounts of money, how much you're going to give to this fund or that fund. You have an obligation by when you've made a public pledge, a very very strong obligation to fulfill your pledge. It's considered a neder, and you have to get that pledge fulfilled, and it's very very severe in the eyes of Allah. Okay, so 407 does not deviate from anything that you've committed yourself to through a neder, being aware that even if you didn't make a neder, there's a prohibition in the Torah of lying. The Torah says, midvar sheker tirchak. You must distance yourself from falsehood. So lying in general is prohibited. Here there's an extra prohibition to not deviate from something which has been bound through a neder.
Please turn the tape to the other side.